HPPodCraft.com.
Mordiggian is the god of Zul-Bazair, said the innkeeper with unctuous solemnity. He has been the god from years that are lost to man's memory, in shadow deeper than the subterranes of his black temple. There is no other god in Zul-Bazair, and all who die within the walls of the city are sacred to Mordiggian. Even the kings and the Optimates, at death, are delivered into the hands of his muffled priests. But Elaith is not dead, protested the youth Farium. Her malady is one that assumes the lying likeness of death.
A malady caused by a weekend in Vegas for her friend Julie's bachelorette party. Where'd that black eye come from? Why did they get matching Twilight Sparkle tattoos? Did they even watch My Little Pony?
I know somebody who watches My Little Pony. That was a pretty specific reference.
My son enjoys My Little Pony. I suffer through My Little Pony.
Oh, your son, huh?
Mm-hmm. I'm not a brony. If I was, I'd be proud about it, but I'm not. That was the intro paragraph to Clark Ashton Smith's The Charnel God. This story was selected for us by listener Emily Johnson, who was a supporter of our live Provenance show in 2017 at Necronomicon. And Emily, we owe you a debt of gratitude.
And the reading was by Jeff C. Carter. You just met him recently.
I did.
He went on our Star Wars virtual reality adventure with us, which was really fun.
Super fun.
We went with Andrew Lehman as well. We were all stormtroopers together.
Yes. Yeah, it was a really cool experience over in the Glendale Galleria when I visited Los Angeles.
One thing you might not know about Jeff, he's a novelist.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yes, his new novel, Criterion, is available now as an ebook on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, Smashwords, wherever you get your e-texts. It's been published by Crossroads Press. Let me hit you with the synopsis.
Okay, yeah.
Criterion is the world's mightiest hero. His sidekicks just found his body.
Oh, no.
The cadets are shattered by the death of their idol. Unable to maintain their brave and plucky facade, they are consumed by strife and jealousy. The only thing keeping them together is terror.
Oh, no.
There's some more description, but yeah, let's leave it there. Folks, pick up Criterion now. We'll link out in the show notes. You will not be disappointed. On to Clark Ashton Smith, today's author, whom we have covered plenty of times on the show. He's the weird romantic of California, pen pal to H.P. Lovecraft, and a pretty great illustrator as well.
Yeah.
If you remember, he's an artist. This story, The Charnel God, originally appeared in the March 1934 issue of Weird Tales, I believe with an accompanying illustration by Clark Ashton Smith.
This story feels like a Conan Hyperborea thing. It feels as though it's set in a prehistory civilization, but it's actually not.
No.
It is set in the far future and is in the whole Dying Earth genre.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that when I read it. Throughout, there's no indication of that in this story.
No, there isn't. It was in my research when I found it. I was like, oh, whoa. And there's a whole collection of Clark Ashton Smith's Zothique stories. I believe that's how it's pronounced. This is a continent, Zothique, that was made up of parts of the Middle East and Northern Africa. It's so far in the future that there's continental drift has happened. Technology has totally been lost, as are all the current religions of the world. But magic is in full use, and there's people messing around with demons and sorcery and, you know, Lovecraftian gods. Smith wrote 16 stories in the Zothique continent. After this one, I gotta say, I am super interested in these.
Yeah, this story is really great. Although, I gotta say, Zothique sounds like it would be a store at the mall where you would get Ankh earrings and a Jack Skellington wristwatch. Maybe some clove cigarettes, something in crushed velvet. It's just got that. You know, shopping malls are really on the rise right now. I think that would be a good investment strategy for me. I'm gonna pitch this store to investors, Zothique. You know, it's like Hot Topic had sex with a Bath and Body Works and it cried afterward, and Zothique is that sad baby that was born from that coupling. And, you know, you can get a shirt with a wizard on it there. I think it's a hot pitch.
Yeah. Are malls really doing well right now?
No, malls are not doing
well. Okay, I was going to say.
That would be a bad choice of... to put my vast fortune.
That would be a terrible idea. No, I just thought that you were privy to some information that I was not. Okay, good.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm glad you corrected me, because I know that a lot of people listen to HP Podcraft, not just for the weird fiction, but for investment strategies, and I wouldn't want them to mistake a joke for actual solid fiscal advice. Don't open stores in malls. I mean, unless, maybe in your town, the malls are good. Here they seem to be turning into office space.
Yeah.
You mentioned Conan. Robert E. Howard, the creator of Conan, actually also liked this story. He wrote to Smith in March of 1934, "I was glad to see your illustration of your really magnificent charnel god. That story is really a tremendously powerful thing. Sinister figures moving mysteriously against a black background of subtle horror. I don't know when I've read anything I admired more."
Wow.
Yeah, pretty high praise, but I don't want to set expectations too high. Let's see what you folks think. Let's jump in.
All right. This story starts off with the city of Zol-Bazahir, where the charnel god Mordiggian is worshipped. Not only worshipped, but this city-state seems to be kind of a theocracy controlled by the Mordiggian cult.
I love the name Mordiggian. I read this and then I was saying it all day to myself. It just feels good to say it, Mordiggian.
Mordiggian. Mm. One of the laws of Zol-Bazahir is that when you die, your body is given over to the temple at the center of the city. No exceptions.
If you die in that city, that's what's going to happen. Even if you're just there to shop at Zathik, too bad.
The rub here in this particular story is that this young guy, Farium, and his wife, Elaith.
I was calling her Elaith.
Why?
Because it sounded more like Lord of the Ringsy to me. You're calling it Elaith?
Well, Elaith, yeah.
Either way, it doesn't matter. It's fantasy talk.
It's fantasy. It's all made up words anyway. They were traveling through the city, and she has a bout of a disease where she enters a death-like coma for hours or even days at a time.
Yeah, that old cataleptic fit. And we've seen this many times before. Folks, if you have catalepsy, do not go into a weird tale. If you can avoid it, you're going to get buried alive. You're going to go crazy. Something worse. Stay out of the weird tale section of town.
Don't do that.
Be by your doctor. Farium knows that she is going to come out of this fit because it's happened twice before. So he absolutely knows that this is what it is.
At the inn that they're staying in, the innkeeper saw that she was ill, called the doctor, and the doctor pronounced her dead. So he called the cult to take her away. Farium pleads with them. He's just like, she's not dead. She just has a disease. We came from the city of Xylac. We're just stopping through here. We don't worship Mordiggian there. Even if we did, she's not dead. So forget about this rule of yours. That's dead people go to Mordiggian. Okay, I get it. But she's not dead. So please, don't take her away.
Yeah.
His pleas fall on deaf ears because basically everyone is afraid of this cult.
Outlanders are not exempt, the innkeeper says. The dark maw of his temple yawns eternally, and no man, no child, no woman throughout the years has evaded its yawning. All mortal flesh must become in due time the provender of the god. The writing in this story is excellent.
Yeah, it is.
Now, you say that everybody's afraid of this cult and that's why they put up with this, but I say actually they're putting up with it because this is a pretty helpful service they seem to be providing the cult.
It's true.
I've unfortunately had to deal with some funeral arrangements and expenses a couple of times, and I don't know if this cult just took care of all that stuff, I wouldn't be too displeased by it. It's kind of like a public utility or something.
Yeah, I agree with you. You wouldn't have to deal with any of those things, and the dead person's taken away.
Yeah.
If you're squeamish about what happens to your body after you die, then maybe you might have some problems. Me, personally, I don't care.
Do it. Let's go. There's some good history on Mordiggian here. It says, Mordiggian is old and omnipotent as death. He was worshipped in former continents before the lifting of Zathik from out of the sea. Through him, we are saved from corruption and the worm. I like that, see? It's like, we know Mordiggian. If he eats us, it's cool. Instead of these random worms, we don't know these guys. Even as the people of other places devote their dead to the consuming flame, so we of Zul-Bazahir deliver ours to the god. Awful is the fane, a place of terror and obscure shadow untrod by the sun into which the dead are borne by his priests and are laid on a vast table of stone to await his coming from the nether vault in which he dwells. So that's the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it works.
The innkeeper says, giving the bodies to the temple, keep corruption out of the city. No one but the cultists have ever been into the temple. Mm-hmm. And these cultists wear masks of silver and gloves with purple robes so that men may not see those who have seen Mordiggian. Farium asks if he can talk to the king, maybe, you know, appeal to him about this, saying that she's not dead, so it doesn't really apply to your rules. But the innkeeper says that the king must obey the cult. Even the wealthy and the nobility must give their dead to Mordiggian. And while they talk, the priests arrive.
Four strange figures came into the room, heavily garbed in funereal purple and wearing huge masks of silver graven in the likeness of skulls. Their very hands were concealed by fingerless gloves. There was a horror about them, of which the macabre masks were only a lesser element. A horror that lay partly in their unnatural, crouching attitudes, and the beast-like agility with which they moved, unhampered by their cumbrous habiliments.
Now, he says fingerless gloves, which I thought were gloves with the fingers cut out, like a 19th century tramp.
That's what I thought, too, like that, or like Madonna. You can get yours free, by the way, with a pair of goggles today at Zathik. special sale.
But what I think he's actually talking about, they're mittens.
Right.
Because they, without spoiling things, once their hands are revealed, you can see that they're not like quite human hands.
So by fingerless, he means there's no space for fingers, right?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose he wrote it that way because there's just no way to write mittens and have it sound intimidating.
You're right. That's so true. Mittens is the cutest word in the English language. I mean, you couldn't say macabre mittens. Wouldn't work. I mean, it would ruin the macabre, you know? But how about this? What if you put the word moist in front of it?
Oh.
Does it... Moist mittens. Ooh, yeah. Moist wins. That's disgusting. That's the one word that mittens can't overcome.
So these cultists are superhuman, and they come in with this gurney-type thing seemingly made of bones and leather, maybe even human flesh. They say nothing to anyone. Nobody talks to them. They don't talk to anybody. They just get on with their business. Farium goes nuts and pulls a dagger on one of them and goes to attack. Farium is lithe and panther-like, but check it out. These priests are like ninjas and have the swiftness of tigers. And tigers totally beat panther, so they take him down.
Tiger beats panther. Everybody knows that, yeah.
He comes to after they've gone, and the innkeeper says that the priests are merciful. They get the weakness of man in his grief, so they aren't going to punish you.
Yeah, they knocked him out, but they didn't kill him or anything, and I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, it makes these priests somewhat compassionate as well.
Yeah.
And I think it means that one day, the thing that really strikes me about that is definitely in the temple one day they had a seminar on non-lethal restraints and takedowns. I mean, they would have had to, which means you know that there's one of the, you know, priests of Mordiggian is there and his job is to run those training sessions. You know, guys, there's donuts and coffee in the conference room. Let's go. Come on. 4 hours of training, all mittens on deck.
So Farium gets up and gets his dagger and is off. But the innkeeper warns him, their mercy has limits. You better not follow them to the temple or they're going to take you down for good. And the innkeeper says, well, actually, I can tell you're not going to listen to me. So you got to pay me before you go because I doubt you'll be coming back. So Farium pays him and then he's on his way. The new day is dawning as Farium begins to search the city for clues to where they might have taken his love. We get a little backstory here on Farium while he's on his search. He's impoverished, but of noble blood. He was exiled due to his political and religious beliefs, his family's beliefs, actually, because they did not align with the new emperor. Farium was taking his new wife to Yaros, where people were more like-minded and he would be welcome.
This is great because you set up with that immediate dramatic situation. Then we learn a little bit more about the character and you find out he's fleeing religious persecution. So now we're on his side even more.
Yeah.
You know, he's already lost a lot. Now he stands to lose the one thing he has left.
They traveled with a caravan, but were ambushed by bandits and they fled off on camels, getting a bit lost and ending up in Zul Ba'Asahir. Zul Ba'Asahir was a hub of trade, so there are many rumors about Mordiggian flying around. Some believe that there is actually no god, only his priest that actually eat the dead.
I kind of immediately thought that's probably going to be the big reveal, that there's no god and they're just a bunch of cannibals.
I thought that myself.
I was wrong.
Some said that the bodies were being allowed to rot before being eaten. Others said that they were ghouls that lived in the temple and that they might even control the cult. That possibly Mordiggian may exist, but it might just be a really big ghoul himself. People also say that the priests practice sorcery and dark rites.
With all this going on, Farium's kind of surprised as he's going through the city toward the temple to see people just going about the common business of life.
The people in the city seem normal in almost every way. They barter, they laugh, they gossip, and this normality calms them a bit.
I think they're happy because of the money they've saved. No making payments on a cemetery plot. No getting upsold on coffins.
No?
That business. By the way, pro tip, funeral directors, they know you're probably going to buy one of the first three coffins they show you because you're grieving. You're not up for a bunch of comparison shopping. That tends to be what consumers do. They also know that you don't know what the price of coffins are, right? It's not something you would have been shopping for before this moment. So what they do is they show you a really crazy expensive coffin, then a pretty expensive coffin, and then an expensive coffin. And people typically will buy the middle priced one, right? Because they think, well, I don't want to be a cheapskate, but I don't. So they get the really expensive one, which is a huge price gouge. You can actually order a coffin from Costco and have it delivered to the funeral home, and lawfully they have to allow you to do that.
Oh, wow.
Just some advice for folks. Yeah, you do not have to buy from the funeral home, but often you think you do.
In the UK, you can be buried anywhere and you don't even need a coffin. You just need the permission of the person who owns the land. So if I wanted to, say, bury my, I don't know, my dad when he dies, if I wanted to bury him in my backyard and he died in England, I could do that. And I don't have to put him in a coffin. I don't have to do any of that stuff. It's my land. It's my property. Oh, wow. I can do all that stuff.
I'm glad you said when he died, because at first I thought what you were saying is that in England, you can just bury anybody you want.
No.
At any time. Wow.
No.
Like, murder's legal as long as you bury them alive. Where did that tradition come from?
Queen Victoria thing. She buried lots of people alive, set a trend. It was the Christmas tree, and then it was burying people alive. Those were the things that she started.
Oh, yeah. That's where, yeah. And the snowman is usually somebody who's trying to claw their way up out of the ground, and they freeze. And that's where that tradition comes from.
You know that carol?
Hear the screams in the night. Tomorrow we'll have a snowman fight. Who's that wailing on the wind? It's the snowman.
You do know it. You do know the song.
I do. As it turns out, I do know that one.
Back to the story. Farium is freaking out, trying to figure out a way to rescue Elaith. He pulls himself together and he goes and tries to talk to the locals, seeming like a curious tourist, not a man who's going to defile the temple of their god. He learns that people don't really pray to Mordiggian or actively worship it. They just kind of offer up their dead and things work out. Mm. You know, most people feel he's pretty benign, which he totally is.
Yeah.
Everybody seems pretty happy about this public service. Nobody can actually describe, however, what Mordiggian is supposed to look like, thinking maybe it just might be kind of an elemental force and not an intelligence. Nobody knows how the cult actually recruits new priests, though some people think that they are actually men and women, the priests. They're not just men. Mm-hmm. Some think that the priests aren't actually even human, but immortal subterranean creatures.
A lot of gossip about these priests.
So much gossip. So Farium also discovers that the temple at the center of the city is quite open. Anyone can walk in, but no one does. So Farium decides that he's going to go in at night to avoid anyone seeing him enter, because seeing somebody enter would attract a lot of attention, because they're like, whoa, who's this crazy guy that's going into the temple?
Yeah.
While making his way through the city, he sees some more of the priests carrying away a young woman. And he at first thinks that it's Elaith, but it's just someone who kind of looks like her. It's a noble woman, and he follows the priest secretly.
She looks like Elaith in that she's a woman.
Yeah.
But it says, her features, though pale as those of Elaith, were crowned with curls like the petals of heavy black poppies. Mm. Her beauty, warm and voluptuous even in death, differed from the blonde pureness of Elaith as tropic lilies differ from Narcissi. Smith has read his Archie. He knows you can't just have a Betty. You got to have a Veronica, too. That's basically what he said.
So when the priests walk by, people stop what they're doing and they're quiet. Farium overhears some people talking as they walk by that this woman is Artella, daughter of a high noble and magistrate of Zul Basahir. She died quickly and mysteriously, and there is suspicion to foul play.
A cause unknown to the physicians killed her. Most importantly, it said it had not marred or wasted her beauty in the least.
Hmm.
Now she's dead, but like a hot dead. Oh. She's got that Zathik look.
So Farium follows them to the temple, which is a big ebony thing with purple gray stone at the bottom with veins of color running through the stone. So it kind of gives it this look of rotting flesh. He waits there until nightfall, wondering what could be happening to Elaith. Is she still asleep? Is she now awake? What horrible things could they be doing to her? And now we cut away to some other characters.
Adnan Thaw, sorcerer and necromancer, was felicitating himself on the bargain he had made with the priests of Mordiggian. He felt, perhaps justly, that no one less clever than he could have executed this bargain, through which Artella, daughter of the proud Quas, had become his unquestioning slave. Artella was seemingly beyond the aspiration of a sorcerer. Adnan Thaw, however, was no common hedge wizard, but an adept of long standing in the most awful and profound arcana of the black arts. He knew the spells that kill more quickly and surely than knife or poison at a distance, and he knew also the darker spells by which the dead can be reanimated. He had slain Artella in a manner that none could detect, with the rare and subtle invulturation that had left no mark, and her body lay now among the dead in Mordiggian's temple. Tonight, he would bring her back to life.
Haha, we got a necromancer!
Yes.
Adnan Thaw, and he is allied with the priest of Mordiggian. He's got a plan to make Artella his slave. He made a spell to kill her that would seem natural, like a natural death, and would leave no mark on her body. And the fact that that is mentioned makes it sound like kind of a sex thing.
That's kind of exactly what it is.
Yeah. So he's going to bring her back from the dead so that she will serve him, which it's so creepy.
What a great villain, though. I miss guys like this, you know? Powerful, scary, low moral quality. Yeah. He's not conflicted or sad about losing some woman in his past.
Nope.
He's just enslaving this woman because he's a jerk.
Yeah.
He's a bad person. And that's what... evil necromancers do.
Yes. So Abnon Thaw is not from Zul Basahir, but from a place called Sotor, which is also the place that Thomas the Tank Engine is from.
Is that right?
It is. Yeah, the Isle of Sotor. And he has two helpers with him. He is training these two weird guys to be necromancers as well.
The training, by the way, is on Thursday afternoons in conference room Dory. Abnon Thaw likes to name his conference rooms after popular Disney characters just to keep the workplace fun, you know? But seriously, guys, be on time.
The priests are allowing him to practice his dark arts in the temple as long as he eventually gives the bodies back to the temple. He told them that he could help them out by making sure they were in good supply of the dead. So is he killing people?
Yeah, since he's arrived, there's a lot more bodies. But, you know, they also stipulate that he can't take the bodies out of the temple.
Yes.
It's not that he can take them and then bring them back. It's like they'll let him practice his necromantic arts, but it's got to be where they can be around within the temple. It's kind of like how you let your kids drink at home. Like, I remember being weirded out when I was visiting and you were stopping at the store to buy the boys' vodka. And you said, hey, they're going to drink anyway. I'd rather they do it at home. And, you know, I know where they're at. So it's that same. It's that same kind of thing that you do.
I don't do that. My children are 6 and 3 years old.
Yeah, well, this was a couple of years ago, so they were like one. Yeah.
So please don't write letters. I'm a bad father for a number of reasons, but that is not one of them. So Abnon Thaw's two cronies, Nargai and Vemba Sith, are also out-of-towners and pretty loyal to this guy. They made all the preparations for the resurrection of Arctella. The plan is to raise her from the dead and then get on these racing camels that they have all readied up with supplies and things and head south to get away from the priests because, you know, these priests are going to be pretty ticked off. Nargai brings up the fact that this might be a bad idea. Both Master Abnon Thaw and Vemba Sith... Vemba Sith, these names, man, they're just such a mouthful.
Yeah.
They all go, no, it's fine. We've got this totally planned out. There's nothing to worry about.
Nargai's nervous because nobody's ever escaped the temple with a dead body.
No.
He says, long ago it is told a high noble of the city bore hence the cadaver of a woman he had loved and fled with it to the desert. But the priest pursued him, running more swiftly than jackals. And the fate that overtook him is a thing whereof the legends whisper but dimly.
Mm.
Scary business what they're engaged in here.
Yeah, and so Nargai says, Mordiggian watches all things eternally from his black vault beneath the temple. Abnon Thaw says, well, mere superstition. There's nothing to confirm them in the real nature of corpse-eating entities. So far, I've never beheld Mordiggian, either sleeping or awake. But in all likelihood, he is merely a common ghoul. I know these demons and their habits. They differ from hyenas only through their monstrous shape and size and their immortality. And I'm like, what? Wait a minute, dude. You want... They're immortal and you're okay with pissing these guys off?
Yeah, that's a pretty big difference from your garden variety hyena. They're different only in that they're immortal.
Yes. And they could talk. They're intelligent.
Yeah.
His final argument is, you know what? We've earned this. We've worked here for a long time. We've done a lot of good work. So we've earned a body that we can take out.
Mm.
And we just want one woman for our purposes. Again, not being specific.
And then we cut back to the hero.
After the sun sets, Farium sneaks into the temple. It's very creepy. It says, crossing the threshold, he was engulfed instantly by a dead and clammy darkness, touched by the faint fetor of corruption and a smell as of charred bone and flesh.
There's some hallway action. You know, he's got to sneak through while priests are passing by here and there, making his way in.
He finds the room with lots of dead people in varying states of decay, all of them laying out on a big slab. There seems to be no order to this line. There's rich and poor, young and old, men and women. They're just all laid out.
I like that the cult is very egalitarian, you know. So far, I have no problems with them.
Yeah, not at all. Finally, at the end of all these people, he finds her.
Yes, Aleth.
She's still in her sleep and seems unharmed. He sees the body of the woman Arctella lying next to her, and he goes to lift Aleth up when someone comes in. So Farium runs and hides. It's the master and his cronies. Unfortunately, they notice Aleth and are like, she's pretty hot. Can we take her too? And the master says, sure, as long as you can resurrect her on your own. I'm not going to help you resurrect her.
He goes, I have no time for a double incantation.
So they grab her and then they get out of there.
No, I was so distressed that they did this.
Yeah.
They just saw her laying there. Why don't we grab her too?
So Farium realizes what they're up to and he gets out of hiding, but they're gone with both Arctella and Laith. Farium follows them into this very swanky room, all pillowed and jeweled out, but it's a wizard's lab.
Welcome to Wizard Lab, formerly Conjure Wife, the sorcerer's source for sexy fun. Wizard Lab, life is short. Why not experiment?
So Barium sees the master and his dudes getting ready for the ritual. For some reason, he's kind of enthralled by what they're doing, and he seems unable to act. We kind of get a look and a description of these guys. It says the master is a tall, middle-aged man. The second guy is a younger man with lecherously slitted eyes. Mm-hmm. So like snake's eyes, I guess.
Or I think they're just narrowed because he's being so lecherous, you know.
It's creepy. I see. Okay.
You know, turning Japanese, I guess, like what that song was about, right?
Oh, jeez, God. Yeah, that song would not fly nowadays.
No, it's both racist and filthy.
Yeah. And the last guy, young and evil of aspect, merely he stood and looked on with an apprehensive, uneasy air. So that's our last guy who's been the whole time going, I don't think this is such a good idea. Everybody goes, you don't know what you're talking about.
I wish he'd give one of them 3D glasses or something so it was easier for me to tell them apart. But whatever.
They start the ritual, and the two are going at it at once, but Alaith is the first to stir. She wakens, and the necromancer stops chanting while the master continues his. Then Artella rises, but she's all zombied out. She's not there. It's like she's some kind of meat puppet. But Vemba Sith can't help but throw some shade. He says, behold, oh, Abnon Thaw, my spells are swifter than yours, for she that I have chosen awakened before Artella.
I thought to throw shade, it had to be more of a backhanded compliment kind of thing. Because he's just kind of bragging there.
Yeah, it is bright. Well, he's...
Shouldn't it be more like, oh, that's so cute that you used that old spell that takes forever?
That is better.
You're such a good teacher. You know, I did this immediately.
Yeah, that is. See, that's better shade.
So that only he knows he's being insulted.
Yeah.
See, you taught me well.
Oh, the student has surpassed the master.
You see, I did it. I turned it around on you.
You did.
You taught me so well that I did better than you.
You threw shade back at me.
Oh, man.
It never ends.
It's too much. It's so dark. With that much shade.
So I can't even see my notes anymore. At that moment, Barium is unable to act, and he jumps out to kick some ass. But Nargai has some sweet moves and disarms Barium.
Struck the knife from Barium's fingers with a darting blow that shattered its thin blade at the hilt. Damn!
Oh, so Vemba Sith is prepared to kill him when Abnon Thaw commands him to stop. He wants to know who this attacker is, this guy who's got the cojones to come into the temple, and he says he's Barium, and that he's here for his wife, Alaith. She's not dead, and she was just has this sleeping sickness. And he wants to take her and go.
Abnon Thaw maybe has some respect for Farion. You know, you're very bold to be here in this temple. Maybe he's faking it. I'm not sure. But they do a quick round of intros rather than kill each other. He says, yeah. I am Abnon Thaw, the necromancer. And these others are my pupils, Nargai and Vemba Sith. It's just a weird scene. Normally, when we meet somebody new, we play the name game or do a scavenger hunt so that everybody can get acquainted. But there's not a lot of time for that. It's also awesome that Farion dispels Vemba Sith's bragging that you mentioned a minute ago.
Yeah.
He's like, you didn't bring her back to life with a spell. She was never dead. Your spell probably didn't work at all.
Abnon Thaw is like, well, me and my pupils, we're just getting ready to blow town here. You said you got to leave. Maybe we should all go together. Wouldn't that be cool? Farion doesn't trust them, but he needs, you know, to get his wife out, so he's going to play along. Artella is totally an automaton. She just does only what she's commanded to do. She's got no expression.
Which I'm sure is a dream girl for these creeps, right? Oh. And I think that when real life guys are finally able to get that, that's going to be the death of the human race. Not nuclear war, sex robots. Population is going to shoot through the floor. It's just going to be old people and a bunch of dudes locked up in their rooms.
As they're going to leave, Farium suspects that there's going to be an attack from Vemba Sith. So he flips over one of the braziers right into his face. And Nargai goes to attack Farium, but he stops seeing something horrible. Now, Farium at first doesn't want to look, but he feels compelled to turn around and see what it is. Something huge fills all the doors and windows of the room.
It was a bulk of darkness that somehow blinded the eyes with a strange dazzlement. It seemed to suck the flame from the red urns and fill the chamber with a chill of utter death and voidness. Its form was that of a worm-shaped column, huge as a dragon, its further coils still issuing from the gloom of the corridor. But it changed from moment to moment, swirling and spinning as if alive with the vortical energies of dark eons. Abnon Thaw fell back before it, with frantic mumblings of malediction or exorcism. But Artella, pale and slight and motionless, remained full in its path, while the thing enfolded her and enveloped her with a hungry flaring until she was hidden wholly from view.
So Mordiggian is real.
Yeah. I loved it because I thought it was going another way, and it wasn't. It was going this awesome, cool way. So, and it gets better. So Ferium holds on to Elaith as all hell breaks loose. The darkness envelops Arctella, and when it moves away, she's just gone. Nargai, he screams, he's in hysterics. He says, it was the god Mordiggian. He has taken Arctella.
Into the room from the dark hall, there poured a horde of creatures whose violet robes alone identified them in Ferium's eyes as the priests of the ghoul god. They had removed the skull-like masks, revealing heads and faces that were half anthropomorphic, half canine, and wholly diabolic. They had taken off the fingerless gloves. Their curving talons gleamed in the bloody light, like the hooks of darkly tarnished metal. Their spiky teeth, longer than coffin nails, protruded from snarling lips.
They're ghouls!
Yeah!
They're Lovecraftian ghouls! They're the kind of the wolfish, the canine-featured...
The Pikmin's model ghouls.
Yeah. Yes! Oh, man, I was so happy. Because I thought maybe when they say ghouls, you know, a lot of times these stories, they just mean people that are creepier monsters that eat dead people. But these are freaking full-on ghoul ghouls.
Actual ghoul ghouls, yeah.
Oh, man, I was so happy when I was reading the story. I was joyous even.
You got the real thing.
I got the real thing. So these ghouls surround Abnenthaw and Nargai. And then some others come in and they jump on Vemba Sith because remember he got that hot brazier thrown on him. The ghouls totally ignore Ferium and Elaith, but then one of the ghouls turns and he talks to Ferium. He says, go, for Mordiggian is a just god who claims only the dead. He has no concern with the living. And we, the priests of Mordiggian, deal in our own fashion with those who would violate his laws by removing the dead from the temple.
This cult is pretty amazing, man.
These ghouls are so cool.
Ferium, with a lathe still leaning on his shoulder, went out into the dark hall, hearing a hideous clamor in which the screams of men were mingled with a growling as of jackals, a laughter as of hyenas. The clamor ceased as they entered the blue-lit sanctuary and passed toward the outer corridor, and the silence that filled Mordiggian's fane behind them was as deep as the silence of the dead on the black altar table.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end of the awesome, awesome story. I loved it so much. I don't know if we did it justice. It's just a great read. It's got super cool stuff in there. It really tripped all my triggers. It worked for me.
Yeah. It's a great world. It's a cool set of conflicts. It's got some good action. It's got some fun characters. Everything about it's great.
Yeah, what I really liked about it too is the fact that the ghouls were in there. And they were actually pretty benevolent and like cool. When I always play the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, I like to use ghouls in my stories more as allies, like strange allies, because their goals aren't counter to most people's goals. You know, like they just want to eat dead people and study their books and hang out underground.
They're very conservative.
So it's like
family values is what ghouls are about.
And I always thought that these horrible things, they're doing these forbidden, gross, I mean, they're eating dead people, that's pretty gross, but really, who are they hurting? Nobody.
No.
And I think that the story just totally kind of knocks that up to 11. There's a whole city that's kind of ruled by ghouls. I mean, these ghouls have got the best ghoul life you could possibly have. They can go into the city, pick up the freshly dead, and lay them out as long as they want, just the right amount of rot that they like in their dead person.
Same way you'd age a piece of beef.
Yeah, or some a fine wine.
That's right.
Or some cheese. It's just such a cool story. And then Mordiggian is a freaking real thing, so they're doing some stuff with that guy too. Ah, God, it was just so neat, and I like that Ferian, he wasn't a Conan dude. I thought he was going to jump in and kill a bunch of guys. He got his ass kicked up and down every time.
He did. That's
so
true.
It's a little bit more Lovecraftian in that way.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of, for me, there in so many ways, it's a real mix of Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft, but like kind of the best bits of both, it almost felt like to me.
I agree with you 100%. And we're going to get more of that next week. We've got another Clark Ashton Smith story called The Testament of Athamaeus.
Yes, yes.
I've read it already, and I know I liked it. I cannot recall right now what it was about, but I'm going to reread it, and I'm excited because it's more... I don't know if it's takes place at the Zothique storefront, but it possibly is in history, but it's another sword and sorcery kind of thing. And so if you awesome. Like this, man, you're gonna dig on that.
I want to thank Emily Johnson for picking this story, having me read it, and giving me maybe some of the greatest amount of literary joy that I've had in a long time.
Listen closely.
I want to thank Jeff C. Carter for being awesome, for sounding great, and being one hell of a rebel pretending to be a stormtrooper.
That's right. You can get Jeff's book, Criterion, now in ebook format. You can get it from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, Smashwords, wherever you buy those kinds of things. Pick it up, read it. That's all we have for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com, where cool ghouls rule!
hppodcraft.com